This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Political dialogue seems to be a scenario that might come in the long rather than in the short term. At the same time, it's the only possible way to get the crisis resolved.
That's Giovanna Di Maio, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Center for U.S. and Europe, on the prospects for peace in Libya. Details coming up. Also, violence has erupted again in Cameroon. Uganda is the latest country in Africa to revive its airline. And for the first time in 5 years, elephant hunting will be legal in Botswana. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, violence has erupted again in Cameroon as preparations intensify for a national dialogue called by President Paul Biya to end the conflict that has killed at least 2,000 people in the country's English-speaking regions. Scores have died in recent days and electricity has been cut, mostly in English-speaking towns, when attackers set fire to power distribution equipment. From Yaoundé, from Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports, the military has been deployed to replace teachers who have once again fled to safety.
45-year-old Godfred Mitsuge heeded the call of the Cameroon government to return and teach in the English-speaking southwestern town of Mamfe when the school year in the Central African nation began September 2nd. Mitsuge has again fled for his life to Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
It's because of the insecurity that I was traumatized. My children were traumatized, and there are many people who had, from the trauma, they went to serious depressions, and from serious depressions, some even passed on.
Mitsuge said violent attacks by separatist fighters intensified when Cameroon's President Paul Biya on September 10th announced that he was convening a national dialogue to solve the crisis in the English-speaking regions, but did not release separatist leader Ayuk Tabe and his 10 collaborators who have life prison sentences by a military tribunal in Yaoundé. 47-year-old Etienne Baku, who has also fled from the English-speaking northwestern town of Ndop, says he thinks that the violence will stop if the president frees separatist leaders.
You know what I think he should be added before the dialogue is, he should personally grant a general amnesty to the detainees to calm down people who are angry so that they should participate in the dialogue.
The new violence has left about 25 dead in the past 2 weeks. The electricity supply has been interrupted in many northwestern towns after separatist fighters pulled down and burned high-tension cables and electricity equipment. They also destroyed 9 schools and blocked several roads into the English-speaking regions and blew up tankers transporting fuel to English-speaking towns. The military said it had deployed troops to protect civilians and their property. Colonel Sonny Joseph Ajang, Director of Administrative and Regulatory Affairs in Cameroon's Ministry of Defense, says they have deployed teachers who are also military personnel to schools hardest hit by the violence.
Their role is to teach and to ensure that security in the school vicinity is guaranteed.
Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's English-speaking Southwest region, says fighters should drop their guns and have confidence that the dialogue will address issues they have been raising.
I'm appealing to drop their arms, to stop all the atrocities. Our children are not going to school for 3 years. Please, can those who are preventing children stop? Can those who have disturbed the economy because they wanted the dialogue stop, so that we go to dialogue now and come back with peace?
Cameroon's Prime Minister John Guté has been consulting with political party leaders, civil society activists, opinion leaders, traditional rulers, lawmakers and clergy to gather their proposals, which will be submitted for examination during the national dialogue announced from September 30th to October 4th in Yaoundé with the aim of achieving a definite return to peace. Civil society groups and opposition political parties are calling for the unconditional release of Anglophone separatist leaders and other political prisoners before discussions begin. Separatist groups have on social media called the dialogue a non-event. They say they became a sovereign state called Ambazonia on October 1, 2017, when Ayuk Tabe, their leader, declared their independence. They want the international community to intervene and press the government in Yaoundé to order its troops out of Ambazonia. The conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking regions has killed more than 2,000 people, internally displaced more than 500,000, and caused more than 50,000 Cameroonians to seek refuge in Nigeria, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Fire swept through a maternity hospital in Algeria before dawn yesterday, killing 8 newborns, including twins. Dozens of other patients and staff were evacuated. Officials say a defective anti-malaria device may have sparked the blaze in the town of El Eud near the Tunisian border. An investigation is underway, and the district health director, the director of the hospital, and the hospital security team were suspended. Another fire hit the facility in May, though no one then was reported injured. As Libya's armed factions continue fighting to control strategic assets, Egypt and the UAE are supporting the military campaign of General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, while Turkey and Qatar are backing the government of National Accord in Tripoli. Germany has offered to host a UN international conference on Libya after warning that the country could slide into Syria-like chaos. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi discussed possible scenarios in Libya with Giovanna Di Maio, visiting fellow at Brookings Center for U.S. and Europe.
I'm very pessimistic about possible scenarios for Libya at the moment because the situation, the political dialogue seems to be a scenario that might come in the long rather than in the short term. At the same time, it's the only possible way to get the crisis resolved with maximum engagement for local communities, but also there must be an important stand of sense of international community against and condemning the attack that Haftar did in April 2019.
We saw that the United Nations tried to use the Libyan agreement as a basis for reaching a political solution in Libya. What are the other possible alternatives to reach a political solution in Libya?
Now, one important step would be really enforcing the arms embargo so that Haftar he would be weakened by the fact that he would not receive as many weapons as he used to, and war for him would be more costly. So political dialogue, there will be a conference in Berlin early November in which the Germans are trying to convene different parts of Libyan society and actors. And political dialogue will be pursued, keep on being pursued. At the same time, there must be strong stance to reach a ceasefire and stop the fights.
Would France and Italy play a positive role in that conference in Germany?
France and Italy have been competing over Libya for their dominance, for like energy reasons, but both of them are willing to stabilize the crisis. So probably after Haftar's attack on Tripoli in April, this has probably reduced his international credibility as an actor who could actually both fight the Islamic State and take Tripoli. So probably this might bring France and Italy closer together and try to work out a solution that is shared, and so that having the European Union having a strong stance together with one single line of operation. This might not be like supporting one or the other, but might be a different solution for the political process.
What should the United States do to stop its allies from fueling the protracted fighting in Libya, whether United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Qatar, or Turkey?
So the United States benefits from like large support between the Libyan public opinion. The United States is seen as a honest broker that could be playing a good role. I believe that U.S. should use its diplomatic potential to disincentivize United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt to fuel the war through importing weapons into Haftar. So I think the U.S. should use its diplomatic potential and push harder for arms embargo and for a different setting for the country that does not involve like extreme power of militias.
That was Giovanna Di Maio, visiting fellow at Brookings Center for U.S. and Europe, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Uganda is the latest country in Africa to revive its airline. East Africa now has 5 national carriers in all. However, a trade group predicts that most will lose money this year due to high fuel prices and the inability to sell all the seats. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
If you are living in East Africa, you may soon have several airlines to choose from if you want to travel within the continent. Uganda is the latest to bring back its carrier after 30 years offline, joining its neighbors Tanzania, Kenya and Rwanda. Joseph Muvawala is the head of Uganda National Planning. He says the reasons behind bringing back the airline were economic.
Our citizens were losing close to $500 million US dollars in economic value in the cost of tickets. So we needed to increase the supply of air transport to reduce on the cost of tickets. At the same time, we as a country have a lot of exports that we are doing, mainly in food crops, which are perishable, and we needed a connection.
Meanwhile, Kenya policymakers are looking for ways to save their country's carrier, which has been losing millions of dollars. Some lawmakers want the national carrier to be run by the government. If that happens, the chairman of Kenya Airways, Michael Joseph, wants the carrier to appoint the top managers.
We do not want to create a situation that we had before, where you nationalize an airline and all it becomes is a department of government. The board of directors is loaded by friends of politicians, etc. We want to make sure that if we create a nationalized airline, that it will operate as a semi-autonomous airline and a semi-autonomous airport industry.
The International Air Transport Association, or IATA, predicts that African airlines will lose money this year, as in the previous 4 years. Andrew Matas is the IATA deputy chief economist. He says all the African air carriers have high operating costs.
For example, we know that fuel costs for airlines within this part of the world are something like 35% higher than they are elsewhere in the world. So that's, you know, fuel costs account for something like 25 to 30% of an airline's operating costs. So fuel costs are critical. When we think about costs, we also think about taxes and charges. And some of those, as I said, may be country specific. So we need to look at and understand what's happening in that regard as well.
Ethiopia Airlines is the only carrier in Africa doing well, helped by the presence of the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa and Ethiopia's proximity to Asia. Muvawala says the other East African national carriers, including those of Tanzania and Rwanda, should consider creating one regional airline.
What the leaders of East Africa now have to do is to look at how do we then put all these resources together to make ourselves more powerful.
People in the East African community bloc are already free to move across borders and trade freely. Whether the countries can cooperate to form a regional airline remains to be seen. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
19 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For the first time in 5 years, elephant hunting will be legal in Botswana, with authorities planning to issue nearly 160 hunting licenses in coming weeks. The Southern African country says the elephant population has gotten too big and needs to be curbed. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube has more.
In May this year, Botswana lifted a ban on elephant hunting, citing growing conflict between wildlife and humans. The country has an elephant population of more than 130,000, more than double its official capacity. 72 licenses will be given to non-citizens and will be awarded through a bidding process for next year's hunting season, expected to begin in April. Another 86 licenses have been reserved for locals and are being awarded through a nationwide raffle system. Participation in the raffle is high. Maung, a wildlife zone in the northwestern part of the country, saw 5,990 locals jostling for just 8 elephant hunting licenses reserved for the area. The government has said the licenses are not transferable, but a raffle winner who preferred anonymity says this makes them less attractive.
It would have been ideal if the hunting licenses were transferable so that me as a local, I can sell it to an international hunter to raise money. Now, as it stands, the benefit is the meat and keeping the trophy.
Locals pay $800 for the license, and hunters will be accompanied by wildlife officers for the hunt. The trophy, including tusks, cannot be exported and should be kept by the license holder. Despite the high interest in hunting licenses, Maung resident Boniface Kiakabetswe feels the $800 fees was too steep, particularly for rural communities.
They were actually raising, concerns about the price, you know, the license price that is paid once for people who have won the elephants. You know, it's around 8,000, and they will say that, you know, many people, as you know, that the communities and people who are living in the community who are part of the people who have applied for these elephants are actually poor, and many of them will not afford that 8,000.
A farmer, Davidson Mabedla from Kgobajango in eastern Botswana, where more than 250 elephants have moved into human settlements, says the allocation of hunting licenses was not balanced.
It's a pity that there are only areas that has been identified for hunting. The hunting licenses that have been issued, I want to tell you, is not going to help us here. The only thing that we have to hear, or we are going to hear, is another death, is another destruction of crops.
Botswana's Minister of Environment and Natural Resources, Kizo Mkaela, says the hunting season will start off slowly and cautiously. He says quotas were allocated in areas where there is increased conflict between humans and wildlife. The first session of the hunting season runs between September and November. Mkondisi Dube for VOA, Gaborone.
President Donald Trump has urged world leaders to promote religious tolerance, claiming that approximately 80% of the world's population live in countries where religious liberty is threatened, restricted, or even banned. During a visit to the United Nations, Trump pledged $25 million to counter the trend. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Sam Brownback, the U.S. State Department's Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. Brownback began by explaining the enormity of his job.
The job entails fighting for religious freedom all around the world, for all faiths, all the time. So it's a very broad brief, but it's also one of those that the United States government has really taken up and strongly pushed. That's why the president did his signature event on religious freedom this year here at the UN. And my hope is that now you're going to start seeing nations truly push to see this done instead of ignoring the problem, which has taken place in their recent past.
When you say fighting, what do you mean? I assume that's a metaphor.
Well, yeah, it is a metaphor, but the metaphor is that they will stand up and will do something, whether it be sanctions against countries that persecute people for their faith, whether it be publicizing this in nations, whether it be really doing this in private diplomatic circles in ways, saying, you know, look, these policies that you have, the blasphemy laws, the amount of fighting that we have taking place in some nations between Christians and Muslims, where people are getting killed. The government needs to stand and make sure they're protecting both faiths, all faiths, people of no faith that want to express their beliefs, that they protect them.
One thing that you said at the beginning of your speech today was that protections and the violation of protections for religious freedom is almost a precursor to the protection of other rights. Are you saying that there's actually a connection between religious pluralism and these other benefits, or that they all sort of come along as a bouquet all at once?
When you're willing to protect a person's religious freedom, you generally are willing to protect the rest of their rights. If you're willing to persecute a person for their religious beliefs, you're generally willing to persecute on a number of other rights. It's generally the trend line of what we're seeing.
Fair enough. In Africa, what are you looking at particularly? Where are the challenges and where are the positive bright spots on the continent?
In North Africa, there's unfortunately a lot of problems and a lot of challenges. Now, there are new governments coming in places that I'm very hopeful about, like in Sudan. You got a new government coming in after Bashir was removed. There's a real chance to turn around. Algeria has not been a religious-free place, but you got a new government coming in, and here's a possibility. Nigeria is probably the tensest place that we're watching. There are a lot of Christians being killed and Muslims being killed in that nation, whether it's terrorist groups or others. They often will use the religious signature to pick a village out. And it's probably one that people are watching the most because it's the largest population country and just deeply concerned about a huge schism developing there that could go into a very bad situation.
You may be aware that in Africa, especially in West Africa, there are many, many, sometimes I would say thousands of women who are excluded or put in camps or imprisoned, sometimes killed, for practicing a folk religion, which is considered pagan by, say, the Muslim faith, often by the Christian faith. Are those also an object of explicit concern in your brief, these women who are called witches and that kind of thing, maybe just for praying to the ancestors or having a fetish or something?
I'm not as familiar with that as maybe what I should be. What we do try to do is to stand up for whatever type of faith it is, their free ability to practice it if they're not hurting other people in the practice of their faith.
As a diplomat, how do you parse the distinction between cultural norms and the religious aspect?
There are all sorts of lines. In this country, religious freedom cases can be so complicated and difficult, many of them end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Most of what I do is we're just trying to get to basic minimums. You cannot kill people for being of a minority faith. People need to be free to practice their faith or even choose to change their faith. And they shouldn't be given the death penalty or locked up in prison for doing that.
That was Sam Brownback, U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, world leaders gather in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, plus growing Africa's agriculture. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.